Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a special edition of the Heritage Hour on Monday, May 21st, 2012. I'm hearing an echo. I don't have any time, but hold on, folks. Sorry, something's wrong. I'm not sure. Well,
I'm sorry. I muted my mic. Here, there we go. I am very sorry. I apologize for this messed up opening, folks. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is a special edition of the Heretics Hour on Monday, May 21st, 2012. And I've gotten used to turning my mic off now and then, and you know, the same old thing, we forget to turn it back on again. Now, we're being broadcasted live from my, people keep sending me messages. We're being broadcasted live from my website, CarolynYeager.com, and those of you who are listening right now are obviously there and have found the way to listen in. I want to tell you that this program and myself right at the moment are sort of in flux between my former radio home, Voice of Reason Network, and my future radio home, the White Network, which is not online yet. And therefore, because the White Network still needs some fine-tuning by the computer expert who has created it, and therefore another computer expert by the name of Bill Fink has put a radio player on my site so that we can stream from his site out to you, so that there can be this program tonight. And if we don't have a lot of listeners live, of course it will be archived, and I'm sure there'll be quite a few downloads of it, as I've been having a lot of downloads on my site for all of the programs in the last 2 months or so especially. So I appreciate that, and I encourage people to keep coming to CarolynYeager.com and finding out what's going on, and you will be finding out about the White Network. I was on Deanna Spingola's program this morning. I wasn't expected to be on this morning, but someone canceled, and we had been talking about it, and so I got to go on. And so if anybody caught that, I gave out some information about the new network that I won't repeat right now, because I expect that we will be doing a show from there next Monday, and we'll be talking about everything that has to do with it at that time. So I'm going to introduce my special guest tonight, whose name is Severus Niffleson, who has an interesting blog with the title of Niffleson's Mind. It's at niffleson.blogspot.com, and it's spelled N-I-F-L-S-O-N. I'll let him explain his name after I say hello to him. So hello, Severus. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, you sound very good. Not too loud. I hope I'm not too loud. I turned my voice down a bit.
You sound perfect.
Good. All right. Well, now we can get going. I'm sorry I screwed up the opening up. Nobody could hear me.
That's not a problem.
Amazing. Well, anyway, The first thing I'll start with is you explained once before when you were on my program, you were on several weeks ago, and we talked about the Adolf Hitler's political testimony, the short one, the real certain one that we know is his. And you explained to me how that name worked out, you know, how you get the name Severus and how you got the name Niffleson, because this is not really your name. So what does all that mean?
Well, actually, the name Niffleson is somewhat of a creation of mine, because Niffle in Old Norse, right, it just means the mist, right? So Niffle was the land of mist. Niflheim is the land of mist. So the idea of being the son of mist was significant to me, because it implied a mysterious element that I think intellect should have, right? You know, something that is mysterious that that entices you to further look into it, right? So that's the reason for the name. I kind of made it up, but probably it may exist in the Scandinavian countries. I just never found it, and so I thought it was a cool name to utilize to just, you know, speak my mind out, right? And Severus is just a great Roman name that etymologically just means that you're severe, right? So,
okay.
So severity in ideology is good. So that's it.
Very good, very good. I'm glad you explained that. Again, I do like that mist. I had forgotten what it stood for, the Niffle. But so it should be clear by now to the listeners that you're European-minded, and you think you explain to me your relationship with European and how you look at, and you're white nationalist, so how you look at white nationalism, and we'll go in. We've got three topics here that I said in my announcement: variations on National Socialism, and two, Strasserism, which is one of those variations. And three, European white nationalism. So I guess we'll keep that for last. But still, you know, what is your position on between Europe and United States and all of that and white nationalism?
Well, that's an interesting question. There have been a lot of books that discuss this, irrespective of white nationalism, that discuss the separation between mainland Europe, per se, the European political culture and the American political culture, because even though it's pretty obvious that the United States is basically the sun of Europe, not only because Europeans populated the United States and conquered it and built a nation out of it, but because their political theories are basically European, right? But there has been somewhat of being disinherited in a way. I like to see it that way, and almost that the United States has gone its own way and have become almost exiles of European political thought in a lot of ways. So even though Americans are still influenced in some way by European thought, in reality, they're on their own planet, right? So in a way, I think that the most interesting thing about white nationalism is the reverse influence of American white nationalism on Europe and the struggle that has with legitimately European conceptions of nationalism. And I think that's what is going to make interesting this talk, because Strasserism, third positionism, leftist type of nationalism are very European in their conception, whereas Americans are almost on another planet when it comes to this perspective. And I think that's what makes it interesting.
Okay, go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is, in my experience, is that because I am a son of Europe, literally, like we all are, right? But I'm also a son of Europe when it comes to my my development, my early development as a child. Then, and my grandparents and my parents are basically European, right? My perception of political thought is it's somewhat European, except that I've lived in the United States for so long that the combination of them, I think, allows me to see both perspectives from a very particular way, right? And I think that's if I could say that I could provide some interesting perspective on this, is simply because I have been in both worlds, right? So I can feel both conceptions of white nationalism.
Yeah, very good. Thanks. I agree with what you say, because we were talking about this yesterday. Was it just yesterday? And we decided that we try to go ahead and do this program, and Bill cooperated with us, so now here we are doing it. And we had about an hour discussion, and it was so interesting to me. Of course, I'm vastly interested in National Socialism, but what got it started was this clip from Tom Metzger radio program, on which John Kaminsky was his guest, and it was just a kind of a short clip, but it surprised me what he said in it. I sent it to you and to Bill, and you found it quite understandable. And we're going to play that clip. I don't know. I want you to help me decide what to do here, Severus. Should we play the clip and then talk about it, or should we talk some about National Socialism first before we get into that? I hate to put that on you, but I'm kind of excited.
It's okay. I mean, we could just put the clip, or we could just discuss the basic gist of it. But I guess because it is what's really started the conversation, it would be legitimate to just put at least a small piece of it, so it can get us, you know, started on it. So yeah.
All right. Well, let's do that. Yeah. Bill has the clip, and he said he could play it whenever I want to ask for it. So Bill, if you can play that clip, and I think you can play the whole thing. It's not very long anyway. It's short. Play it for us now, and let's see what he's saying.
I've been thinking about it for the last few weeks, and I think it kind of puts things into perspective for the whole 20th century. You know, the kaijus lied through their teeth to create the Bolshevik Revolution and to take over Russia. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But here we are. Here we were back then, and National Socialist Germany early on gave the working class and the whole country as a whole the same exact thing, only it was true and it was without the kaiju. And Hitler gave it away culminating in the 1934 Night of the Long Knives, when he made a deal with the industrialists, and the industrialists were nothing but in the pocket of the kaiju financiers. So what happened was, we almost had it. They lied about it the first time, but that's what really was necessary, was not the workers to take over the government, but the workers to have a strong voice in the government. And that's what they had initially in the early National Socialists. They actually had a strong voice, and the meat of their voice was the SA, the brown shirt. And the kaijus behind the scenes all the way knew that that was the big problem, and they had their German industrialists get in bed, you know, entice Hitler. And Hitler, I think, I used to say that Hitler betrayed us. No, I think what happened was Hitler hit his level of incompetence. He couldn't see it. And every inch of the way, he made mistake after mistake after mistake from the dealings with the industrialists onward. But we almost had it. We almost had it if only Hitler hadn't thrown out the strong voice of the working class.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. That is that's the clip. And, you know, I'm not that familiar with Tom Metzger. I knew he was a long-time white nationalist, but I didn't know that he held these views. But he's extremely anti-capitalist and pro-labor, I found out. And so he's probably held these views for quite a long time. And you weren't surprised at hearing it, and you were explaining to me what this was all about. And I want to just add here, since I did try to listen to the rest of the program, the whole program, but then I had to turn it off and I didn't get back to it. But in that program, he was talking about a real revolution in the United States, and said one thing I remember him saying is, we need barbarians for a real revolution. It would be a real bloody deal. You have to just murder a bunch of people, you know, all these elites and so on. And he said he would be too soft for it. He says most of us are too soft for it, but this is what it would take. And then, and to my mind, he includes non-whites in this revolution, apparently, especially Muslims, who he thinks are good fighters. I'm not sure about this, but that was just an impression I got from what I did hear. So let me turn it over to you, Severus, and you say what you want about this clip.
Well, first of all, let me just say that Tom Metzger, I don't know if we could call it a movement, but I've been a white nationalist almost all my life, for more than 20 years, right? Tom Metzger is an elder of the white nationalist movement, so I respect them just for that fact, right? So I don't even, you know, I wouldn't dare necessarily to, I'm just going to give my opinion on what I've studied from him, but not necessarily kind of go into his mind, right, in his heart. But I do want to make it clear that I do respect him, because he's done so much work for white nationalism throughout his entire life that there's something that merits respect, right? Okay, so dealing with his perspective, I've always known from what I've read from him that he was basically a third positionist and a Strasserite. And we'll go into that a little bit later, right? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. But the point is that his perspective is what Americans will call a more radical leftist revolutionary conception of white nationalism, which is actually pretty common in Europe, but that's what got us into this conversation, right? That is actually his opinion would be like the common opinion in Europe in a lot of ways, especially in the younger type of generation. when what you just mentioned about the non-whites, he is a straight white nationalist. He does believe in separation. It's not that he believes that he would, at least from everything I've heard from him, it's not that he would allow these people to live in their own homeland, but he has a classic third positionist view of other races in the sense that he believes that they, and we could ally ourselves with a lot of these people to create independent nations that are separate type of thing, right? So in other words, these Muslims could participate in the national liberation movement because it is in their interest to have their nations without our imperial influence in it and vice versa. We should have our own nations without their imperial influence in it. So it's that perspective. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to hang out with the Black Panthers and then we're going to create a nation together of revolutionaries, right? But it's more an issue of, you know, utilizing their revolutionary perspective for the sake of eliminating Jewish influence from both our cultures and creating an independent type of, you know, separate nation. So I guess that would be a clarification of his perspective based on what I've studied from him. But of course, I can't speak for him, right?
Right, right. Well, it seems I just kind of get a general sense from this that the class struggle means more to people like Metzger, and I found out there are a lot of these third positionists who have a revisionist view of Adolf Hitler, and are more because he wasn't pro labor enough for them. They decided, and this started in the 80s or maybe even in the 60s. Yeah, I've got some notes here, but but versus more class, they go toward the class side of things more than just purely nationalist, you know, and the racial makeup of the people. You say that he is that. I do believe in him, and I've always thought so. And probably most of these people are, because there's a lot of German nationalists who think along the same line as Strasserism. So, but they're so pro-labor. They sort of hate the any ruling class. They hate any industrialist class with a passion, and that is not how National Socialism ended up developing. And that, I guess, that's where the problem is.
Well, let's do this, right? Let's do a background of this thought, this mentality, right? And if you don't mind, let me make a quick statement. A lot of people are going to ask, what's the point of this? And in the sense that they're going to ask, okay, well, we're talking about all this kind of somewhat complex and obscure philosophies. But the reason is, and I do hold a revolutionary view of white nationalism, I believe that true revolutionaries, or at least white nationalists in general, should dedicate their free time to study instead of watching TV or doing other stupid things, right? They should dedicate themselves to study, not only to be good advocates, right? I mean, good advocacy is important. You have to be educated to be a good advocate, but also to create what Jung used to call synchronicity, right? The better educated we are, the better attuned we are with our culture, and therefore the better skilled we are at, you know, merging ourselves into that current and making sense to people, right? So for us to get a real sense of politics, we have to study politics. So in that sense, that is the reason I believe this is important, because it reflects on the future and it reflects on the current situation. So I just wanted to make that statement, because people are going to ask me, oh, what's the point? Who cares?
Yeah, but, it's true. They will.
Yeah, but it does matter. So if you bear with us, you'll understand why it matters. Okay, so first of all, may I read a very small quote from Adolf Hitler, 1934?
Sure, you do it, whatever you think you should do.
Okay, and you're probably familiar with this quote, right? The quote goes, "It is not Germany that will turn Bolshevist, but Bolshevism that will become a sort of national socialism. Besides, there is more that binds us to Bolshevism than separates us from it. There is, above all, genuinely revolutionary feeling, which is alive everywhere in Russia except where there are Jewish Marxists. I have always made allowances for this circumstance and given orders that former communists are to be admitted to the party at once. The petit bourgeois social democrat and the trade union boss will never make a national socialist, but the communist always will." Right? That's Adolf Hitler, 1934.
Okay, and when was this? Would you say 1930 what?
34.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so why am I, and this is somewhat of a somewhat of a known line of his, because this was him basically talking about communism and National Socialism, and basically identifying National Socialism within a leftist context, right? Because at that time, leftism just meant revolutionary. Rightist just meant conservative, right? And he hated conservatives because he thought they were dragging the nation. And in that booklet that I sent you, right, that pamphlet of the Nazi Sozi, Joseph Goebbels specifically addresses the issue of the middle class, which he despised, right?
In this booklet, people can find it. Well, I might give a link to it. Nazi Sozi by Joseph Goebbels in 1931. And then in 1932, he wrote Those Damned Nazis, an article which had much of the same. It's divided into the same kind of parts. And you can find that on Calvin.edu, and I'll give that too. So, he was saying those same kind of things, which in the same time period, that they were very, very worker and labor oriented, and why.
Exactly. And if you notice, Goebbels specifically kind of insults the middle class, because he says that the nation has to be a working class revolutionary nation. Now, this matters because this gives us a context, right, of where these, Otto Strasser and Gregor Strasser comes from. What's the backdrop of this, right? And the backdrop of socialism itself, because a lot of people, especially Americans, this will join with our discussion of European versus Americans. Americans have a somewhat generalized and narrow perspective on socialism because the history of socialism to Americans is almost detached from them. It's almost like it doesn't exist, right? It's somewhat too European, and they associate it too much with the Soviet Union and with China, et cetera. And they have a detached view of socialism. But Marx himself is a distorter of socialism. Or I would say, to not sound that biased, I guess I would say he has a different vision of socialism. But he's not the founder or the creator of socialism, not even close, because he basically rips off everything of socialism. He just adds his own perspective to it. If someone would be considered to be the father of syndicalism and socialism, would be someone like Proudhon, Proudhon. Mm-hmm. And he's also the father of anarchism. What's interesting is that all these philosophies kind of stem from the same place. Why does this matter? Because this movement believed that true socialism had to be based on guilds, right? It was a guild system in which if you are a shoemaker, then the profits of the shoemaker should be distributed evenly among the shoemakers. But that does not mean that the profits from the shoemaker should be given to the automakers. Do you understand what I mean? There's a separation.
Yes. And Goebbels was talking about that.
Exactly. There's a separation. Marx did not believe this. Marx almost believed that you had to take all the profits, the surplus, right, and put it like in a pot, like in a tip jar that everyone can dig in. But this is his invention out of socialism. Because true syndicalism and socialism did not believe that. Believed that each guild had their own management, but their surpluses stayed within that guild. It did not spread to other guilds. So in other words, you could have guilds that were richer than other guilds, right? Because it made sense. That was the guild that we're in. It didn't imply that lawyers and dentists would share the same profits, right? As an example. Okay. But from Proudhon, okay, you have syndicalism. I've discussed this before, yellow socialism. And then it arrives at Germany with this idea of National Socialism, which is actually French. But the Austrian National Socialist Party took this French idea and made it into their own party. And then the National Socialist German Workers' Party basically took the same idea, right? And they were ab initio, from the beginning, a socialist working class party that rejected Marxism, clearly. I mean, there's no doubt that they rejected Marxism, but they were still socialist. And actually, if you read, which I have, because I believe that every white nationalist, if they have the time, they should read their enemies. They shouldn't just read their own stuff. They should read the other guy, right? If you read the Communist Manifesto, it's right there that Marx specifically attacks what he called German socialism. And as a matter of fact, Fetter, right, the economist, the economist of National Socialism, he wanted, and a lot of these guys wanted to call their party German Socialism, right? German Socialist Party, because this was the name of that, their socialism was German Socialism, which is what's something that Marx criticized, but that's actually traditional socialism. But the point, the whole point of this is to make a case, right, that the original National Socialism and most of the movement was revolutionary, i.e., they did not agree with capitalism. They were anti-capitalist, aggressively anti-capitalist. They were aggressively anti-Marxist because they saw it as an expression of actually bourgeois sentiment. They actually saw it as an extension of capitalism, as a, almost like a Trojan horse of capitalism to basically trick the workers into following it. But really, their purpose is to basically destroy them. That's the view of a lot of these German socialists. And it was pro-labor and pro-worker. And these quotes, the Adolf Hitler's quote, Goebbels' writings are pretty clear on this. I mean, it's pretty clear that that's their objective. Their flag is red, and it was done on purpose. It was a socialist flag. And even the name of the party, right, it specifically is geared towards workers. And there also, there was this, the you can see it in Triumph of the Will, right? There was an issue of you must get class out of your system. You must banish class from your thought, the mentality of class. And that is a socialist view of the world as well. So that is the background, the backdrop of having a man like Gregor Strasser and Otto Strasser in the party, being revolutionaries, being socialists, being racialist and being nationalist, but from a different perspective, and influencing the party, and later on creating this departure that maybe you would like to discuss whenever you wish.
Yes. Okay. Well, let me bring up something that I came across here, and that is in this Goebbels' Nazi Soci book,
mm-hmm.
or like a booklet. This is at the very end of it on page 30, and this is, again, 1931. He mentioned the new man, and he said, we want to achieve the new man who can, and then some other stuff, and then can progress into the future. And, you know, it brought to mind, because I had just been talking about Heinz Linke, well, in that program we did together, going over those books again from the bunker in the last days. And when Heinz Linke saw Hitler for the last time and was given his instructions and so on, and then he said, he asked Hitler, what should we fight for now, knowing that Hitler was just about to take his life and would no longer be, you know, he would no longer be the man to serve. And Hitler answered him, the new man. That brought that back to mind. I'd never heard that Hitler mention that before, but I guess this must have been a kind of a theme they had. And that made me think of Arno Brecker, who was Hitler's favorite sculptor and who fashioned images of these larger-than-life male figures, very muscular and noble and, you know, of course, based on Greek, what the Greeks did. But and these were like the new man, you know, these figures. I understand. As soon as that came to me, I thought, sometimes I thought that these sculptures by Brecker were kind of over the top, you know, and that's how they like to present them. But, you know, like these people were just not real. But, of course, they weren't. They were meant to inspire and stand for something symbolic. But this, again, they're sort of like that you could see them as the new man, someone who is bringing in something altogether new. So I think this all fits together with this revolutionary spirit, and I know that Adolf Hitler considered himself a revolutionary. But you know, would you say that once he got closer and closer to power and was really going to govern the nation and do all that, you do tend to become a little less bloody revolutionary, and I think that the purpose became to bring all the Germans together, because Goebbels goes into that a lot in both of these books that I mentioned, that it was all about bringing the classes into a German nationalism. The German people, you know, had to make a nation and stick together and care for one another. It was all like that. So overthrowing one class of Germans and destroying them for, you know, by another, was really not what they wanted to do. Do you think that's all wet, or is there any truth in that?
No, I understand. That's a measured way. And by the way, my purpose is not to take necessarily a side, but to discuss the issue per se. I'm giving that disclaimer just in case. but what I mean is, yes, that would be the measured way of approaching Hitler's what Hitler was doing, right? Of course, there's always going to be a darker view of it. The Otto Strasser's view of it would be the darker view, and as you can see, Metzger and a lot of people ascribe to it. Because from the perspective of a revolutionary party, right, that's what the Strasser brothers were, their perspective was that you could not do any pact with capitalists or the bourgeois class because they would basically co-opt you because they own you and destroy you. That's the revolutionary perspective from their side. Okay, so this guy, I'll give you an example. It's like almost we have a white nationalist that he's down with us, everything is great, and we elect him to power, and then suddenly he does, he does an alliance with someone that we don't like, and suddenly we're angry at him, right? And you could argue, well, that's unreasonable because he's doing what he thinks is best, and he's probably going to do what's best for the movement, etc. But maybe that's in hindsight. Maybe someone right there in the middle of the situation is not going to see it that way. It may see it as a betrayal of the revolutionary movement. Before we even get to that, what's interesting is that at that time, and of course I can later on give like a list of interesting names that people could actually go into and study. But for example, there was a man called Ernst Niekisch, right? He's a German politician from the time of Hitler, right? He's the founder of National Bolshevism, which is basically it's not even Strasserism. It's like a more radical version of lefty type of nationalism that is actually very popular in Russia right now. But he was actually, interestingly enough, he was part of the Communist Party, right? The what was called the SPD, right? That Hitler addressed them constantly in speeches, etc. That he actually left the party because he became too nationalistic for them. And eventually founded the National Bolshevik Party, which is actually even prior, existed even prior to the National Socialists, interestingly enough. But they're kind of coherent, they're basically at the same time. But they advocated a pro-Soviet stance. In other words, their idea was that the National Socialism should be allied to the Soviets against the hegemony of the British and the Americans, right? Because they saw them as the epitome of capitalism and as the destroyers of the destroyers of European culture. You had another brand, and Hitler actually, in my view, represents this perspective, which is more kind of like an Anglophile, a Germanic perspective, right? An almost love of the British and the Americans in the context of their view of how their culture was going to influence Europe. They had a view that in a positive way, these countries could actually be a good influence to Europe, whereas these guys felt they were the horrible influence to Europe, and the Soviet Union would be a better influence to Europe. And I think this view of the world, which Strasser did share, he was just not a National Bolshevik, because National Bolsheviks are actually even closer, they're actually pretty close to Marxist. They're not Marxist, but they're pretty close. But Strasser wasn't. But this view of the world, you know, kind of pro-Soviet versus pro-Anglo, it's very important because Third Positionism, for example, shares this view. Francis Parker Yockey shares this view. And as a matter of fact, Strasser and Mosley, right, over there in England, they used to write for the same newspaper. Strasser used to write for Mosley's paper. And this is a fight they used to have in their paper, whether or not they should ally themselves with the Soviet Union or they should remain hopeful that the United States is going to be a good influence. I think that in that fight, we could argue who was right, right? But the point is, this issue is important because it's the way that white nationalists saw themselves in the world, whether they were a labor union, labor-oriented nationalist movement of national liberation, or they were a right-wing, conservative, traditionalist movement. And this issue is like the soul of our people. It's the soul of our movement. Which one are we, type of thing?
That's very good. You put things so well. That's very clear to me. And it seems clear that that Adolf Hitler was hopeful to ally with Britain and America, and not with Soviet Russia. He didn't trust the Soviets. I guess he hated Bolshevism so much. What do you think it was?
Well, you know what's interesting about the whole Bolshevism thing is that I'm not going to go into it unless you want me to. What really Bolshevism is, because for example, Tom Metzger utilized the term Bolshevism, but he used it colloquially. But the definition of Bolshevism is independent of Marxism. Because Bolshevism is just a strategy, a revolutionary strategy, whereas Marxism is actually a socialist branch, a perspective on socialism. But Bolshevism and socialism can be connected, but they're independent because Bolshevism just means a strategy, right?
Why do you think that the National Socialists who were under Hitler and allied with Hitler and his government used the word Bolshevik and Bolshevism so much, and that's what they considered the enemy. Why is that?
Well, I'm gonna define Bolshevism, right? Bolshevism historically is basically a branch within the Communist Party, which before was a Social Democratic Party, before it became actually a Communist Party with the Soviet Union, but before it was a Social Democratic Party. Bolshevik literally just means majority. And Menshevik literally meant minority. That's it. That's all it meant, majority and minority. Obviously, what's funny about this whole thing is that Lenin and his party and his group had a particular objective, an idea. His idea was that you cannot win a revolution without having hardcore, radical, intellectual, professional revolutionaries in the party only, and they should reject every other kind of hang-around. So any hang-around, like a worker, like a guy, a shoemaker, who wants to be a part of the party, he should be rejected because he's not really down. He's kind of like, he likes the idea, but he's kind of like a member of the Democratic Party. He's there and he goes to vote, but he's not hardcore. Lenin believed that you could only win a revolution if you had hardcore vanguard type of politics, that you had the top guys going out there and basically pushing their views and leading the way into victory, right? The Mensheviks, right, believed that was not the route to go, that the route to go was to allow everyone to do pacts with people, to kind of join up with different types of unions, etc. Lenin was arrogant, so he just decided to call his view the majority, even though it was actually not the majority, it was actually the minority. That's what's funny about it, because even the term Bolshevik, it was a weird name to apply, because Bolsheviks just meant majority, but they were not the majority, they were actually a minority. And the view itself is a minority view. It's the idea that minority should rule the majority, right? So it's somewhat elitist, as a matter of fact, ironically speaking. Most Jews and Trotsky himself were actually Mensheviks. They were not Bolsheviks. Trotsky switched to a Bolshevik later on in history. Why does this matter? Because the Union of Jewish Socialists, right, was actually Menshevik, and Trotsky was a Menshevik. This matters because they viewed Leninism as being some sort of elitist, distorted, freakish version of Marxism. And that matters later on with Stalin and Trotsky's fight with Stalin, because Stalin was a continuation of a type of Leninist view of the world. But remember, at that time, Bolsheviks win. They win the war and they take over. So the term Bolshevik was literally just a reference to the Leninist revolutionaries who basically won the war and took over the country. So the term Bolshevik was not being used as a technical term, which is used as a general term. Oh, the Bolsheviks over there in Russia are winning the war and they took over, etc. But that's why I made that quote from Hitler. When Hitler was making that quote, that the Bolshevik is closer to a national socialist than a social democrat, because that means that Hitler did understand this difference. Hitler was not not ignorant of this issue, but he utilized it in conversation in a different way that he would utilize it when he's talking to people. Like Tom Metzger, he's saying Bolshevik. I presume he actually knows the difference, but he's using it because when you use the term Bolshevik, it strikes in our heart, right? Automatically it gives us a feeling, just like using the term communist. It gives us an emotional trigger that is effective for political speech. But I'm giving the background of what it is because it's important to understand it, to understand groups like National Bolshevism, which simply means revolutionary nationalist vanguardist. That's really what they're saying when they say National Bolshevik. That's really what they're saying. So I wanted to make that distinction because it matters. Strasser, if you don't mind, Strasser was different than the traditional National Socialist because he believed that the only way to keep that revolution alive was to force Germany into accepting radical national socialists in almost every aspect of government. And that is kind of Bolshevik, right? Because it's the idea that you should only use revolutionaries in every aspect of government to put ideology first and then put everything second. So generals should be not national socialists. They shouldn't be Prussians, right? The head of the labor union, the German labor union, should be a national socialist. He should not be some guy from the Weimar Republic. That type of mentality.
And are you speaking of both Strassers at this point?
Yes,
Gregor and Otto, actually Gregor, just to bring it down to some simple ideas that most people would see it as, Gregor continued to think like Otto, but he just decided to try to compromise and stay in the party and all of that. Or did he actually have some different, more moderate views than Otto? No.
They were very similar because, as a matter of fact, if you read both of them, you wouldn't really be able to distinguish them. But as a matter of fact, Gregor was a national socialist, and actually he ran national socialism when Hitler was in prison, right? I mean, Gregor
That's
was
right.
the guy that ran.
That's right.
I mean, he's the guy that ran the party. But he did believe that he should sustain the revolutionary feeling from inside the party. He had basically like a political view of it. We have to stay within the party.
Okay.
To keep a revolutionary while Otto wasn't. Of course, the ironic thing is that Gregor Strasser got killed for it, and Otto Strasser survived, right?
So yeah, but Otto told some lies, too, to people after he was in Canada. Or the people who wrote about him and said that they interviewed him stuck those lies in there.
There's a British guy, I forget his name, who was obsessed with Otto Strasser. And almost every single book except Germany Tomorrow, Germany Tomorrow is Strasser's book, and I suggest anyone just Google it, Germany Tomorrow by Otto Strasser. And you'll be able to read his entire philosophy is there, and you can judge it for yourself. But there's a British guy who was obsessed with him, and his obsession with him, he wrote a book even about him. Like, he described him as like a hero because he was anti-Hitler. But I think that this guy, because he was British and was anti-Hitler, utilized Strasser as a way of bashing Germany. You know what I mean? I don't know if that necessarily is Strasser's fault per se, but I don't know. This is also historical hindsight. I mean, I do know what he wrote, and I've read the stuff they've written about him. But you know, whether or not he was a particularly nefarious kind of character, I don't know. I'd rather stay more on what he said, what he promoted, not necessarily what he actually felt. You know what I mean?
He may have been, bitter and this and that and said some things. Or this author and interviewer may have put it in different words and so on. So,
yeah, you never know.
Anyway, I was just asking about that.
One of the key elements, and I'll just mention this because you're going to find this interesting, and maybe you'll begin to see a difference. One issue is that Strasser was aggressively anti-imperialist, right? He believed that the way to restore the West, and he actually used these words, the West, Western spiritual and cultural entity. He described the West as a spiritual entity, and this is a Spenglerian view of the world, right? This is Spengler. The idea that societies have, and Jung also, that societies have a certain kind of like a collective soul, right? Like a collective energy that is shared by every member of that civilization. And this civilizations go through birth, life, and death, right? And it's kind of like a cycle. And this matters because he actually did not consider the Soviet Union and Russians to be part of the European spiritual cultural entity. He actually considered them to be Asiatic in the spiritual and cultural context. This is interesting because although he was pro-Soviet, he did not consider them to be European. And that's interesting because he did consider the English to be European, but he was against a union with them, right? So I think that's fascinating. But
this is Spengler. I read that Hitler was not a fan of Spengler. He didn't follow Spengler's way of thinking at all.
Exactly. Exactly. No, and that's where this comes in, right? Because Strasser was a Spenglerian. He basically was following Spengler in this view of nationality. And for this reason, he was anti-imperialist. And remember, he saw Hitlerians as imperialist in a weird way. He viewed that this view of Germany having to be leading the way of Europe, in his view, was imperialist. So they differed in that too. In other words, Strasser saw that the key to Europe had to be a multiplicity of European ethnicities with their own nations and their own languages and their own governments, all separated and all made into microcosms, right? And not unified. He was not really into the unification of Europe under a single type of power. He did promote European confederation or federations, but he did not believe in the idea of having one country lead the way, like the British lead the way of Europe, or Germany leading the way of Europe. Mm-hmm. He believed that was a form of imperialism that at the end of the day would result in more war amongst Europeans, because a Spaniard, for example, would feel like, oh, who the hell these Germans think they are, that type of thing, you know what I mean? So it would create problems. So he was very aggressively anti-imperialist, and that view shocked a little bit within National Socialism, because he did have some National Socialists who had a more Germanocentric view of Europe, that Germany should lead the way, should be the heart of Europe type of thing. The other issue is that the German Revolution had to be the resurrection of the West. So that is a way of seeing Germany as the forefront, but never going over into their territories or trying to influence them politically or even trying to spread National Socialism. Ironically, when Hitler said National Socialism is not for export, he's actually playing to this cadre within National Socialism who disagreed with the idea of spreading National Socialism everywhere, but that fascism should be like Italian, you know what I mean? And Franco should have his own thing, and everyone should have their own thing. He believed in national, there's a quote, national and cultural differences are the soul of Europe. Again, seeing that the soul of Europe is in diversity, and I mean diversity within Europeans, right? I'm not talking about Somalis living in Europe.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Within the Western soul, right, which is basically white, that the diversity of Europeans is really the heart of Europe, that all these different ethnicities should be preserved and protected. You know, the Basque, the Catalans, the Belgian, particular ethnic groups within France, etc. That this biodiversity within Europe should be encouraged and should not be resisted or suppressed in a way. And this view is consistent with Hitler as well. I mean, Hitler had, you could argue that Hitler did not see it 100% that way, but Hitler did have a view of the concept of the nation being something ethnic and not being something that the state represents, right? The French revolutionary way of seeing the state. You cannot just put a border, okay, I'm going to put my tanks over here and this is going to be Germany, and then whoever's in it is a German, right? Because a nation's nationality is not based on fictitious borders. The nationality is based on culture and ethnicity. So they kind of agreed in that. It's just that Hitler diverged a little bit on how he saw the role of Germany in this development. He was anti-imperialist, period, right? And in this worldview, Francis Parker Yockey, who was very famous, and Spengler and Strasser, and again, a lot of the national Bolsheviks and a lot of the national anarchists, a lot of these syndicalists in Spain, for example, agreed with this view. They had almost a decentralizing view of socialism. They believed that the idea of a one leadership, of a Führerprinzip, was problematic, and they disliked it. And obviously Hitler disagreed, because Hitler believed that you had to have a strong leadership position to basically lead a country into victory and lead a country into a more positive a future. If you remember from what you read in Nazi Sozi, Goebbels actually mentions this, because they ask him, what does he think about monarchism? It should be a republic or monarchy? And he goes, oh, that doesn't matter right now. All that matters is socialism. And later on, we can discuss if you want to name a head of state of a king, or we want to name him a chancellor. In other words, he didn't really care about that issue.
No, or a president. But he said you had to have a chancellor.
Exactly.
But the president or the king didn't matter which one.
Exactly. So, okay. But their view was, how much power should this guy have? Strasser believed that Hitler had too much power. He grabbed too much power, and therefore that the road to socialist, to national socialist revolution was through a somewhat partial decentralization of socialist cadres. And actually, when they kick him out of the party, and he's basically exiled, he builds what's called the Union of Revolutionary National Socialists. He actually keeps the name, he just calls them Revolutionary National Socialists. I don't know if you're familiar, but there's a revolt called the Stennis Revolt. And the Stennis Revolt is basically the same thing. It's another guy, Walter Stennis, right? He was the Berlin commandant of the SA. And he was another leftist revolutionary, I should say. I shouldn't use the word leftist because most people confuse those terms. The very revolutionary arm of the Nazi Party, along with Strasser, too. And he was another one that caused a lot of headaches. Because Stennis was a very powerful and important member of the Nazi Party. So once he decided that, no, we have to do a new revolution, we have to do like a secondary revolution to install the SA and give them more power and allow the SA to rule the military, because that's another thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Brown Shirts to run the military. They did not want the...
Yeah, they wanted to replace the whole military with the SA.
Exactly. Which
seems a little strange. I don't know if they were capable. Were they? What do you think? Were they capable of taking on becoming the entire military for Germany?
You know, it's tempting to just say outright no. Of course not. You know what I mean? It depends, because I've actually thought about this in the sense of if you think about it, the SA were not just some guys. Like, for example, when we think of we usually think of like these guys Sieg Heiling over there in Arizona, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, those guys run our army? You're saying, right? But the thing is, these SA guys were not like that. Because most of these SA guys, almost all of them, were already a part of the military or they were veterans, right? So they're a little different. I wouldn't say they necessarily
were. Yeah, and they were very disciplined. I mean, it was a very disciplined organization, right?
Yes, exactly. It's not like we're talking about beer-drinking neo-Nazis, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about...
No.
We're talking about guys that themselves were all, I mean, almost every single man in the SA was a military person already, and almost every National Socialist was a veteran, right? So we're not talking about morons, right? We're talking about people that were really military. Now, the issue is whether or not they would be the same as the aristocratic Prussian officers' corps, right? And you could argue maybe not, right? Because these guys, I mean, they do have a family history of being officers. And that does count for something. I mean, most white nationalists are elitist in a way or other. So it's tempting to say, yes, the Prussians would do better. But you have to admit that having those Prussian generals there didn't really help Hitler out a lot, because they did cause a lot of problems for Hitler, because they were not really committed national socialists. And if you compare to the SS, right, the Waffen-SS, the Waffen-SS had great aces, right? They had great fighters. And they were not part of the Wehrmacht, right? I mean, they were basically National Socialist fanatics, and they did good too. So you could make an argument that if you replace the Wehrmacht with the SS, you wouldn't necessarily have lost a lot, but, you know. But God knows. I mean, I agree with you.
I have to say that argument has a lot of merit. It makes a lot of sense to me. But that's in retrospect. So again,
yes.
Hitler was making this decision before it was known how the Prussian military played themselves out, or how they behaved during the war. So, you know,
that's what you told me. Remember?
Well, once again, you know, you're right. In this instance, he was going along with the more conservative view. He was rejecting the more revolutionary view as being too problematical, and didn't know how that would play out, and he didn't want to. Well, who knows? I'll let you go on with that. What do you want?
Well, I mean, in the Stennis Revolt, right, one of the issues was the fact that a lot of the conservative and what people call the bourgeois, right, felt that they were not going to support Hitler unless he tamed down that revolutionary arm of the National Socialist Party. And he did, right? So that's why you would hear guys like Strasserite guys say things like, oh, he betrayed him for these guys, because that's how it looks to them. Oh, we've been with you from the beginning, and now suddenly you're kicking me out because you want to ally yourselves with it. But I agree with you 100%. A lot of this is retrospect. But this retrospect matters for the discussion we're going to have later on the future of white nationalism, because this moment in our history, and that's why I think it's great that you have a show dedicated to a lot of it to this time, is because this moment in our history, and as a matter of fact, Strasser said this in Germany Tomorrow. Strasser said in his preface that this moment in Germany's history, that World War II, was crucial for the soul of Europe, because that event was necessary. Even though he criticized Hitler, he believed that war had to happen, and that Germany lost, but that loss was going to bring a rebirth in Europe of nationalism of a better kind, of less bourgeois nationalism and a little bit more worker nationalism. Now, you may
I don't know if he's right about that.
Exactly. We don't know if he's right.
No.
Yeah. But we can discuss what's happening in Europe later and see what's happening. You know, and
well,
see
let me, there's one question that's come to my mind. As you were saying how Spengler and what's his name who wrote Imperium and so on, all these people had the same idea as Strasser's, and they backed that. Well, who was on Hitler's side? Who? What important people besides Nazi associates?
Well, I would say that those close Nazi associates are pretty good company, right, too? I mean, if you think about it, I mean, again, Goering is a weird character, right? But because some people hate him, some people like him. But you did have most of National Socialist cadres and intellectuals like Alfred Rosenberg, which I actually do respect, right? And I would say he's like the biggest thinker in National Socialism, Hitlerite National Socialism, if you wanted to like divide it. And he remained loyal to the end. You also have Julius Streicher. He's a great, important character that was very radical, because you could actually say that Streicher is one of the most radical guys that you could find in National Socialism. He stayed loyal to Hitler too, right? So it's fair to say that, you know, you could argue that in that game, Hitler won it out. Now,
well, let me throw this in. What about writers and thinkers? Were there any of those major ones who were? It's, of course, they are all National Socialists who were writing these things. So some of them would have been.
That's why I mentioned Alfred Rosenberg, because I think Alfred Rosenberg.
I like Rosenberg too very much. I don't know why he's so criticized by so many people, but you won't find me criticizing him.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, there's different reasons. Some of them are religious, because he was very particularly
anti-Christian. Yeah,
very critical. Well, you know what? It's interesting, because most of his book is dedicated to Christian mysticism. He just criticized, he believed in the idea of creating a new religion. I think that's what's controversial about him. He believed that National Socialism itself should be a religion, and that Hitler should be like the messiah of this religion, in a way. So his view is also revolutionary, but it's revolutionary in a completely different world level, right? It's like a different planet. And in that sense, he's very important in the sense of keeping in tune with Hitler, whereas you have a guy like Strasser who's like anti-Hitler, even though he still sustains and maintains that he's a National Socialist. And the Stennis and a lot of these guys they were pro-Hitler in the beginning, and then they became anti-Hitler when he acquired a lot of power and felt that he betrayed them to the capitalist. You could argue, you told me this yesterday, and you're right, that you mentioned that in like we did in the last show that we did together, that Hitler did in a way feel that he may have made a mistake when dealing with these Prussian generals and a lot of these bourgeois Germans that basically remain loyal to the capitalist bourgeois mentality of what nationalism is, including the whole a lot of the people are trying to assassinate him at the end. I forget the name. What's the name of the Valkyrie guy?
Starts with an S. Daryl. I can't think of his name. Stauffenberg. Stauffenberg.
Yeah, Stauffenberg. Yeah,
Stauffenberg.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, he, for example, was what you would call a bourgeois nationalist. Oh, that's this is another issue, because nationalism in Europe had two ways of being described. You had what people called bourgeois nationalism, and you had what was called revolutionary nationalism.
And Goering talked about that a lot, and he denounced bourgeois capitalism, said, we hate bourgeois capitalism.
Yes, and so the reason is because, I'll give an example that everyone can understand. Most American nationalists are really bourgeois nationalists. This is what I mean. The Republican type nationalism. That Republican type of nationalism, which is kind of like a cosmopolitan nationalism, is bourgeois nationalism. That would be like a modern way of seeing what they saw at that time. That's why Hitler said that a communist would be a better national socialist than a social democrat, because the social democrat, in reality, is a bourgeois nationalist. He's like, oh, Germany, you know, great for Germany, everything, but at the same time, Germany to them is a jurisdiction. It's not an ethnicity, right? So in bourgeois nationalism is the son of the French Revolution, where they redefine the concept of nation as a legal jurisdictional concept in which everyone who is within a territory is and hails a flag and sings a song for the nation becomes a national. That's bourgeois nationalism. Of course, we disagree with that concept because that would mean that anyone could be a member of if I move to Japan, I'm suddenly a Japanese, right? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it is correct to criticize bourgeois nationalism. Both Hitler and Strasser agreed on that issue. But the thing is that Strasser believed that Hitler betrayed their type of nationalism for the bourgeois nationalists.
You disagree. Go ahead, and then I'll say what I wanted to say.
I just disagree that Hitler betrayed ethnic nationalism. I think that's a crazy view. I think maybe at that time to the guy sounded right, but my point is I do disagree with that perspective. I do believe that Hitler may have been too friendly. That's what the whole thing is ironic to me, that he was too friendly sometimes and too much of a bridge builder. That sometimes he could have used a little bit more revolutionary elements in him. And I think at the end of the war, he did, in a way, agree with that perspective. But that's just me speculating.
Yeah, we talked about that a little. I'll get back to that. I just want to say that I could be way off base, but I have a feeling and a sense that the German soul is more bourgeois than it is revolutionary, and that Germans are not naturally there are, of course, you know, we've already talked about some of them, but the majority of Germans are not revolutionary, and we see how difficult it is for Germans to rise up, you know, against things. They're just law abiding people. And I think that instead of bourgeois, I would say something more like cozy, that there's just a coziness or a love of coziness in the German nature. You know, they're good people and they're homey. And of course, there's exceptions, but they're great leaders, though. They're great. They're certainly great bureaucrats and organizers, but, I don't think that revolutionary spirit is all that strong in the German nature. This is just something that I sense.
No, you know what? That's a spectacular observation. You're absolutely right. And actually, that is it's one of the main reasons why I think that the Hitler took the route that he took, right? I mean,
that's the way he was. He really wasn't this revolutionary, flaming revolutionary like a lot of those Russians were. And Jews, yeah. I mean, he wasn't that way. And so he was trying to find, to move it, just kind of shift it a little bit into something that wouldn't be so bloody.
Yes, I think I agree 100% with you. I think it's an issue of the character of a people. And the movements that they create are part of the character of the people. And I think that in a weird way, that actually vindicates the National Revolutionary, because that's actually another branch of Strasser, it's called National Revolutionary Perspective. But it's an evolution of Strasser. It's almost Strasser's left behind, and there's a new perspective, and that is the idea that movements have to specifically reflect the ethnicity that they claim to represent. And you cannot impose on them something that is out of their character. Because it is true that, for example, Italians, you can make a positive argument that they're a lot more revolutionary in their personality-wise, right, than other ethnic groups. And that's fine, right? The Russians, too, are a pretty aggressive bunch, right? I mean, you can even analyze, like, the modern white nationalist movements in Europe, and you can tell. Like, you can tell the Russians are, like, out there, you know.
Yeah.
busting heads, you know what I mean, and practicing with machine guns, you know. And then the Germans are, like, dancing, and you know what I mean? The point is, every ethnic group, and the French, forget about it, right? Don't get me started. So my point is, I'm joking, just for our French listeners, I'm joking. But what I mean is, every ethnic group has their own personality. And the movement has to reflect this personality to be successful. And I think that in a way that vindicates some aspect of revolutionary national socialism in the sense that after you bypass the history of it, right, and we go now to the future, you have to realize that for this movement to be effective, it cannot stem from one location and be centralized on one group and on one person. It has to be decentralized and localized. And that is really the spirit of the evolution of Strasserist National Socialism and what became National Revolutionarianism. It's a weird word how to put it together, but it makes more sense in Spanish and French. It sounds better. For some reason, English sounds weird. I would call it revolutionary nationalism, autonomous nationalism. These groups, which are the largest groups right now in Europe of white nationalism, are effective and they're starting to grow because they advocate this decentralizing form of nationalism, and I think it's very effective.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that this European Union kind of thing doesn't work in the sense that it's being done to make a big monolithic group out of Europe so it can compete with the Anglo-American monolith and the Russian monolith and the Chinese monolith and so on. But how is this going to do that, therefore, in the world, in, you know, among markets and all of this competition that's going on? It's very idealistic. We like it, you know, European individual nations nationalism and so on. But how is it going to be able to survive? How is it going to work?
Well, you know what's interesting is that Europe functioned that way and competed fine, conceptually speaking, with Europe. I mean, if you think about it, look at Britain, right? I mean, Britain was not part of anything, and
Well, that's right. And yeah. You know, on top of that, I have to jump in here. On top of that, Germany could pretty much function on its own as Germany right now and be a major nation and a major competitor and a market in the markets and so on. It certainly is. It Germany's being pulled down by all this rest of Europe that's claiming its resources and its
no, I
finance.
Agree. I agree. Yeah. And not only that. this idea of capitalist union is basically trying to give the death blow to Europe, because again, Europe historically, and I do agree with Strasser on this, which is that Europe historically has been a multi-ethnic European entity. And it that characteristic of Europe is what makes, in my opinion, Europe beautiful in a lot of ways, right? It also makes Europe stronger because it allows each ethnicity to develop on its own route. And also, it does not force one group to impose their values on the others. Because if Italy decides to become multicultural, it cannot obligate Germany to become multicultural. But if Europe becomes multicultural, then the entire region will become multicultural. And that's actually the purpose of Jewish hegemony, is to basically create out of Europe a capitalist version, a United States of sorts in Europe, under the guise of like a social democracy, right? Of a more socialist, supposedly, more socialist nation. But in reality, Europe would do a lot better if we could sustain our independence, ethnically speaking. And the other reason is because we can gain power that way a lot easier too. I mean, if you think about it, if white nationalists in the southern French region can dedicate themselves to just do local politics, they can acquire a lot more power than if they have to compete at the European Union level. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to achieve. And this is what they did to the United States, right? The United States had their own states, local politics, and when it became more federalized, it's almost impossible to gain power in the United States without going through millions and millions and millions of dollars, right?
Yes.
So yeah, this separation, this it's ironic. It's almost like the Europeans are making the case from a socialist perspective, right? But still, they're making the case of, hey, We should be like a confederacy. We should be like the least amount of cross economic cooperation, the better type of thing. And I think that is the spirit of a lot of these national revolutionary movements. And you see the flags of Strasser's flag everywhere. When you go to Europe and you see them in marches, you see that flag. Most people see it, they don't recognize it. But you see that black flag with the red sword and the red hammer, and you see black flags of national anarchism, and you see syndicalist flags, which are red and black. Most white nationalism in Europe has become revolutionary, or has sustained its revolutionary element, but it has also taken an autonomous concept of white nationalism, that we must survive by fragmentation. We cannot survive by Jewish unification, right? Because it's not true unification. It just means the destruction of identity, the acquisition of a common language, and i.e. capitalists coming in and being able to sell you products easier, because now I don't have to translate every single advertisement I make into these hundreds of languages. Now I can just make it in one language and push it to people, and people will buy my products, which I think is a very Jewish conception of the world. But I do agree with the capitalism, the Hitler agreed. Capitalism is a horrible freaking thing. It's a horrible thing. And I think imperialism is a horrible thing. And if you want the best example of this, look at the United States, which basically is surrounded by the effects of their imperialism, right? And Europe is affected by the effects of our imperialism. So in other words, imperialism is pretty bad and capitalism is pretty bad. And I think we all would agree on that.
Well,
at least in the movement of National Socialism, most National Socialists would agree that capitalism is bad and imperialism generally is bad.
Well, what would we have if we didn't have any capitalism? And what would it look like if you've already talked about that some, but can you go into that a little bit more? What would it look like, say, in Europe, if these nationalists made more progress and things started changing in their direction?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult thing to answer, because it's going to be reflective of the particular ethnic group. As an example, the German, as you correctly pointed out, have a particular personality. So they're socialist, because it will be a socialist organization, right? But the socialist form of government that they would apply to themselves would be different than a Galician in Spain would apply to themselves, as an example, because of their personality. But it will still involve labor-centered organization, which is called syndicalism. It would basically involve this. It would involve an economy that is primarily ran by guilds and by workers, but without the Marxist influence of spreading the wealth around from guild to guild, but actually people working in their own guilds and having the right and the freedom to determine how that guild is managed and how that organization functions and how they engage the economy. Remember, this is not necessarily a utopian. It sounds utopian, but it's
but
not.
But it sounds like the Middle Ages.
It's not,
how,
yes.
How much is this like the Middle Ages?
Well, it's not feudalism, right? Feudalism, in the sense that I use the term guild, because that's actually the correct term. But the thing is, mm-hmm. it's funny because that's an example of trigger terms. When I use the term the guild, you automatically think of Middle Ages, right? It's like an automatic thing that mm-hmm. our brains do. But Middle Ages. But guild just means, let's say syndicate. Let's say labor union, right?
Well, I like the word guild better, but...
Yeah, guild is better. Guild is better, yeah. But syndicate also works. But a guild could function in modern society. Almost all modern society actually works this way. It's just that we allow speculators, most of them Jews, to basically own those means of production and own the surplus of that production, and then they take it and they send it to Israel, as an example, right? Or send it to New York. But they own it, and they own a fictitious concept of surplus, right? Because surplus is something physical, but they take that surplus, they turn it into an investment, something of an investment capital, and then they sell it, and then they acquire debt, and they sell that debt as well. And all Jewish monetary systems are based on speculation, right? And Hitler believed, and this is not Hitler's invention, this is socialism, which is the idea that you have to base your economic well-being and your currency on labor, labor-based currency. That's what National Socialism is. So if you ask me how would it look, it would look basically what National Socialism was doing. It would look similar to what Mussolini was doing, but it would be decentralized. It wouldn't be as centralized as Nazi Germany was, or as Mussolini was, or as Franco was. It would be a little bit less centralized.
You mean like even in Germany, say, it would be less centralized than it was under Hitler?
Exactly. It would be
okay.
a more
local.
More local, exactly. You could still have a party that it's centralized, but the point is decisions will be made more on a local level, kind of like the agrarian concept that Hitler himself and Walter Dare, right? Walter Dare was the agrarian, the guy that ran the agrarian movement over there. That was his view. He was from Argentina. That was his view, an agrarian view in which the farmers ran their own thing. They didn't have a bureaucrat in Berlin, for example, telling them how they should run, right? They would have a more decentralized concept of the economy, still within nation. That would be the best way of describing how it would work. Some nations have done it before, and then capitalists go in and they basically exploit the surplus. Almost always these people are Jews, right? It's just that Americans have basically been brainwashed into a feeling of security with capitalism, because capitalism to them is almost equal to freedom, which is it's insanity, but they actually do make the connection between freedom, because they think that if I can open a store and sell widgets or whatever, I can sell hats, somehow I'm free, because I'm selling hats at a store, and this somehow means freedom, right? Even though you have to pay a bunch of taxes, you have to pay people under the table, et cetera, et cetera. But Europe doesn't see the world that way historically. Europe is inherently socialistic in the way they see the world, and I think that nationalists are pushing on socialists to again go the route of nationalism as a positive thing.
Well, how so? To get rid of capitalism, you have to get rid of the Jews, right? So there we're back to the same problem that Hitler was trying to solve, that we have to move the Jews out of Europe.
Yes, of course.
And we have to move the Jews out in the United States.
Yes.
And this, now, how? Give us some suggestions for that.
Wow. I mean, I think that the scariest thing in the world for any enemy of a people, right? Because you can make this argument of like the Japanese oppressing the Chinese, right? An example. The worst thing is the masses, right? Angry. You know, when you have the masses angry at you, they tremble. And this is an example of why National Socialism in Germany was so powerful, because this movement was a workers' movement, right? And remember, Marxism's objective is to take the energy of the workers. This is my opinion, my interpretation of what Marxism is, okay? The Marxist objective is to take socialism and castrated, right? That's really the point of it, in my opinion. His objective is to basically take that energy of the masses, of revolution, of basically stringing up by the neck the capitalist, and he's basically internationalizing it and castrating it by making it a universal issue, making it an international issue in which we all have to join together. In other words, it's almost like you have oil, boiling oil, and you just throw water on it to kind of lighten it up. But National Socialism itself was real socialism, and for that reason, it was a very scary concept, because true socialism has to be nationalistic, because it is protective of your own workers, and it revolutionizes your workers, right? It tells your workers you have to be revolutionary, and you have to aggressively eliminate those who oppress you, and those who oppress you are foreign power and foreign capital. And foreign capitalists, and even local capitalists, because their view was that a German capitalist was doing the bidding of the Jews, because he was in the pocket of the Jews, which I would say it's actually pretty much very true, right? So their perspective is a very powerful perspective. That's why National Socialist Germany was so powerful. I think Marxism castrates it.
I think that Hitler got the cooperation of the industrialist class and the probably the Junkers class and so on, because of the fear that they had of the mass of the working this workers' revolution, and he thought that might work, where he could get everybody to uh, to to work together, but in the end, these industrialists are pretty hardcore in there.
Well, that's the thing. The thing is that these industrialists are almost, remember the horse vessel song, right? The red front, he creates as a red front, and the reactionaries. Those guys are reactionaries. Conservatives are reactionaries.
Yes.
And reactionaries are like the most hated people by most revolutionaries, be they Leninists, be they National Socialists. The reactionary is like the most hated group of all, because the reactionary is the one that's trying to keep the chains on you, right? And most Jews are reactionary by nature. That's their strategies to always tone down revolution. And what's ironic is that Marxism is reactionary, because the Marxist objective is to basically tone down revolution by saying, no, nationalism is all nonsense. Forget about all that good stuff. Let's talk about the international workers' movement, right? It's the purpose is to basically spread out the feeling, right? Because a German's not going to feel the same about a Chinese worker that he does about a German worker. If you make it national, you make it personal. If you make it international, you make it impersonal. Therefore, you make it less masculine, less aggressive. And that's the Marxist objective. What's ironic about the whole thing is that Leninism actually put some juice into it again. And that's the only reason that it won anything. It's not Marx. If you left it up to Marxism, nothing would have happened, right? It's just the workers would be whining and complaining and doing protests, but nothing would have happened. But Leninist ideology, which is itself is elitist and aggressive, is the one that, ironically enough, I don't think he even did it on purpose. I mean, conceptually speaking, when it comes to this Jewish hegemony, created a group of people that could actually do a revolution. That's the idea of what's called socialism in one nation, the Stalinist concept of socialist in one nation, which means that socialism can only be advocated within one nation. It cannot be concentrated on an international struggle. It has to be promoted within the context of the culture of where it is being promoted. In other words, socialism in China has to be Chinese, and it has to be contextually Chinese. It has to reflect Chinese reality, that it's agrarian, that is imperial, that the Chinese people have a character that is different than the German and the Russian, that type of thing. That concept is a Leninist concept that is completely alien to Marx, because Marx didn't believe in that at all. He believed that everyone in nature didn't have a hierarchy, was everyone. It's kind of like the noble savage of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? That in nature, everyone's like some almost an idiot savant, right? That it's all kind and all loving and doesn't share property. It's a fantasy, but the purpose of that fantasy is to convince the working class that they can achieve this fantasy called communism, which is not socialism, is the result of socialism is communism, that they can resolve the stateless, classless, raceless, sexless utopia. And of course, this is nonsense, and I'm willing to bet that Marx knew this, but the purpose of all this utopian thinking is to basically make the workers neutered and not fight for their rights in their own nation against those who are oppressing them in that nation.
Nationalism is just key and must be promoted and stressed, right? I mean, we have to have nationalism. It starts with that. And then, so Hitler named this right, and that's why it's still a popular name, National Socialism, is what works. So how do you see what's happening now in Europe amongst these nationalists? How are they doing, or what hope do you see, or how does it look?
I think it's, I'm very positive, but I think it's looking great. I mean, I'm actually very happy to be alive in this moment in time, because I think that the resurgence of Europe is it's palpable. You can feel it. And you can feel it, and not only the classic examples, right, like the Golden Dawn, which is actually National Socialist, that's actually it's not like a Strasserite type of movement. It's actually just straight up National Socialist in a lot of ways. But you can feel the movement in Europe of the more radical revolutionary groups actually having a voice. Why does this matter to me? Because I am a vanguardist. I do believe that vanguardism, which is this idea that you have to have revolutionary cadres of hardcore 24/7 revolutionary thinkers, right? Because revolution is a state of mind. Is a way of seeing the world. It's not just taking machine guns and no. Revolution is a state of mind in which you view the current system as something that has to be eradicated, and has to be replaced with something new and revolutionary. And this state of mind has to be at the forefront of the fight. And I do believe that vanguardism, which is taking these people who are the hardcore guys, I guess that makes me a Bolshevist in the traditional sense of the word, but not in the modern sense of the word. I am a believer that a vanguard of radical revolutionaries is crucial in Europe to, and everywhere, to basically lead the way of the rest of our people into an eradication of Jewish influence, an eradication of capitalism, and this consumer culture, which is really the child of capitalism, that is basically destroying and making white people degenerates. Not only white people, it's basically screwing the entire planet, but I mean, addressing my own people, right? Addressing my own people. It's destroying our people. And the way to fight this is by having these revolutionary vanguard leading the way. And I think that's what's happening in Europe. You have like the Swedish resistance movement that is doing a great job. They're national socialists, traditional national socialists, leading the way over there. They have now the Finland version, the Finland movement. They have the Norwegian movement. These guys are doing a spectacular job. They're every day out there, and they're revolutionary. They're out there in the street, constantly doing propaganda, educating. They actually have classes educating their cadres of their revolutionary cells on, look, this is the you have to read these books. You have to educate yourself. You have to go out there and spread the message. And then in continental, you know, like in France, Spain, Italy, you do, and in Germany too, I would say, Austria, et cetera, Romania, you do have a lot of these revolutionary, socialist, working class white nationalists that I think are great. They're doing a great job. Autonomous bases, as they're called, or the autonomous nationalists, they're out there every day. They're basically, the socialists are complaining, the Marxists are complaining because they feel that these guys are infiltrating them, because every time they go to a march, there's a bunch of them there, and they cannot distinguish who are who, right? But they're doing an excellent job in promoting nationalism as a legitimately socialist concept of national liberation and autonomy, right? Because if a Marxist goes over and says that Cuba, which was a nationalist revolution, what they have was a national revolution, who happens to be Marxist-Leninist, they have a right to national identity and to national symbols and to national liberation, then why not Spain and France and Italy, right? It's a legitimate question. So they've been able to recruit a lot of Marxists into their movement by making this case, which is what National Socialists did, right? They recruited Marxists into their camp by saying the same thing, right? So I think the movements in Europe are doing pretty good. Spain is doing pretty good right now. I think France, aside from the somewhat lighthearted Front National, they have a pretty good radical nationalist over there. They're doing a good job as well. They're pretty militant. And so I think it's good. I mean, I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's doing good. The question would be the United States, right? How's the United States?
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you see? How do you see the United States? Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, the United States is difficult. I was actually having this discussion with someone in TeamSpeak about what I find fascinating about the United States is the United States has had a basically uniform view of politics since its beginning in a lot of ways, and this is what I mean. In most countries, for example, if you go to France, you're going to have a party that predicates that this country, the French, is doing fine, we just have to fix the welfare system, right? And then you have another party that says, no, we have to manage it in a more socialist way. But then you have parties that say, we have to destroy the state and put something new, right? And you have like extreme right versions of this and extreme left versions of this. My point is the United States doesn't really have that, because most parties in the United States still predicate the same basic idea that the United States is pretty cool. It's just that they're screwing it up. But inherently, the United States is a good thing. And this vision is very particular, because that means that the United States doesn't really have an opposition party. All parties are basically state parties that promote the state, but just different ways of managing the state, right? And I think that's a very interesting development. I would say that the United States is like one of like the strongest uniparty countries in history, right? I mean, they criticized the Soviet Union and National Socialism, but the United States has had a one-party system forever. I mean, let's be honest, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so how are we white nationalists doing in the United States? I say we're doing somewhat bad because we're not really organized, and because most white nationalists in the United States are reactionary and somewhat bourgeois, and a lot of them are libertarians, which I think is really weird, but a lot of white nationalists are libertarians as well.
That's right. They call themselves white nationalists, but, you know, they have a lot of strange views.
Yeah, but their views are very Americanized, so they almost feel like you can have like a collective, like you can have this like capitalist consumer white nationalism. It's a very weird concept that I'm still waiting for someone to explain to me how that would work in a legitimate way. But because I think that the result would be the same thing we have now, right? But I think that the white nationalist movement in the United States has to organize under a more radical, more active vision of what the United States has to be. And then just push that over and over. I mean, in other words, be a little bit more radicalized. Americans let the radical Marxist define radicalism, whereas white nationalists are basically the conservatives, the reactionaries. They're always complaining about what the Marxists are doing, but they're not really themselves doing something revolutionary themselves. And I think Americans, I don't know what you would think if Americans have a revolutionary spirit, but I mean, the United States has one of the revolutions, right? I mean, it should, right?
Yeah, but you know, it seems like in the United States, we have a problem with language. We don't understand the words properly, and we're really manipulated by the kind of words that are used for this and that political words.
Yes. No, I agree. I wrote an article about that. My last article was actually about that exact issue, about the utilization of language to manipulate people.
That's right.
And I was talking to Mr. William Fink about this privately, that what I've always found fascinating is that, for example, white nationalists in the United States, we're gonna do a rally, right? Then they go to the state and they ask permission to stand in front of the government, like the biggest government building they can find. We want to do a rally there in front of the steps, right? So they go there and they basically tell the state so the state can send police, right? Because if they don't have police, they'll probably get beaten, right? That's the idea. So they stand themselves with a platform. They're all Sieg Heiling with flags, with Confederate flags, Klan flags, like a lot of disjointed type of conceptual flags, right? Because you know, like a Confederate flag next to a Nazi flag, next to a Klan flag, it's a little confusing if you think about it. I even seen German Second Reich flags, right? Like the World War I German flags. Which I don't know why you would use that, but anyway.
People like them.
Yeah, it looks cool. I guess.
It's cool.
That's very American, right? Oh, it just looks cool. Let's bring it. Forget about it. Let's bring it. It looks cool. So, but my point is, the point of this is that they stand there with the police protecting them, and then you have the anti-racist and anti-fascist Marxists on the other side of the fence shouting epithets at them, throwing them bottles, and the police are defending the white nationalists. Now, what is the narrative that you see? What you see is that these white nationalists represent the state. They are the man. They are the government. They are the system. And the anti-racists are somehow the anti-system revolutionaries because they have set themselves up in a way that they appear to be the system that's being protected by these lunatics, when in reality, the white nationalist is himself the revolutionary anti-system, and these anti-racists and anti-fascists are in reality the enforcers of the values of the system, because they're out there actually telling you to conform, to submit to state authority, to submit to political correctness. So they are really policing for the state. They are not revolutionary at all. They are the biggest reactionaries you can find. They're the biggest pro-system robots you can find. But the white nationalists are allowing themselves to be viewed as a system because they're allowing themselves to be protected by police by standing in front of a government building. Do you understand what I mean?
I do. But, you know, doesn't it go exactly the same way in Europe? I mean, they're required to get permission to do anything in March. And so then they have the police out there, and the police are protecting the marchers, or if they're demonstrators or whatever, who are the nationalists.
That sometimes does happen, although the police over there seem to be little strange. In other words, they don't seem to be very good at protecting anybody. So eventually, usually these groups beat each other up anyway. But I've seen a development in which that the amount of people, and you can do a search of this, the amount of people in Europe doing what you would call like flash demonstrations are pretty large. There's no police presence, right? And also, a lot of times, the white nationalists get beat up by the police over there. And I'm not saying that this is a good thing. What I'm saying is that for the narrative, it's better for the movement because the nationalists are looked upon as being the rebels, as being the guys who are fighting the system, not as the guys that represent the system. National Socialists, when they used to march, used to get beat up, right? I mean, they used to be and confronted constantly by Marxists and also the police and the government, right? So they were not seen as part of the system. They were seen as counter the system. My point is that...
I don't know if I got lost. What's going on here? Did I drop or... I'm getting a message. Oh, all right. So Severus dropped. So are you calling him back? I will talk then. While he's not here, I was going to ask him about the anarchists, how he sees the anarchists. So I hope he comes back. But this has been very, very interesting. Let me just, while we're waiting for him, are we going to get him back? I don't know. I hope so. In this book, Nazi Soci by Goebbels, 1931. This is from the book The Damned Nazis, which you can get on Calvin EDU, 1932. At the end, the last part of it, it's divided into parts. It says, why are we nationalists? Why are we socialists? Why a workers' party? Why do we oppose the Jews? So they had answers for all of this. That would be coming from the regular bourgeois, and also would be coming from the socialists who thought they were more radical and were not. Although this is 1931 and 32 already, so the Hitler's National Socialist Party was kind of melding down a little bit and trying to bring everybody together and trying to get into the win enough votes to get into the parliament and so on. So Goebbels writes, we do not enter parliament to use parliamentary methods. He's trying to show how revolutionary they are. And he says, we know that the fate of peoples is determined by personalities, never by parliamentary majorities. This is what's behind the Fuhrer Princep and all of that, that you need to have strong people running and not people who are brought out because the parliament has voted one way or another, which we know brings everything down to a kind of a it comes down to a common level. Well, still trying to get him back. Are you back on the line, Severus?
I'm here.
Okay, great.
Sorry.
All right. Well, I was going to ask you right at that point, unless you're not finished, continue with what you're saying, and then I wanted to ask you about where the anarchists fit in to all of this.
That's a good question, because because my connection got disconnected, I kind of lost my train of thought, so I don't even remember where I was in,
okay.
To be honest with you. But the anarchist thing, it's cool, so let's go to it. I don't know if you're familiar with national anarchists, but national anarchists are actually related a little bit to a lot of these movements, to the Strasserites, then the national syndicalists, and then you have national anarchism. And national anarchism is basically very similar to syndicalism in the sense that they believe that, again, guilds should have power over their own workers and they should be decentralized, except that they have a more even a further decentralization of government. In other words, they don't believe in bureaucracy at all. They don't believe that government should have a lot of power whatsoever. There shouldn't be even a state. And they believe basically in local governance, almost like a commune type of thing, but a larger commune of white nationalists. That's basically their view. I'm not judging one way or the other. I'm not saying if it's good or bad. I'm just describing what it is, right? And this all goes back to, again, to Proudhon, because Proudhon himself is the founder father of almost all these ideologies, of syndicalism, more radical types of socialism. He is also the father of anarchism. So all these views are basically related to each other, and they're originally somewhat the same, because socialism is basically a type of syndicalism, a type of anarchist perspective, but a little bit larger, right? Like in a larger context and a more industrial context. It's almost like the anarchists have a more medieval, that's a good way, what you mentioned before, a more medieval concept of community, in which you could actually sustain yourself in a very small kind of tribal environment. That you mm-hmm. only, you can have police, you can have armies, whatever, but it's very small, and the smaller the better type of thing. The free association, the better. But of course, anarchists would allow all sorts of things. In other words, an anarchist doesn't believe that he can go over to the next town if they're like, I don't know, like a bunch of sadomasochist lesbians, whatever. They shouldn't go over there and tell them what to do. Like, that's their business type of thing, right? Now, not all socialists would agree with that. Most nationalists wouldn't agree with that. But my point is, anarchists would agree with that perspective.
How is that different from libertarianism? I mean, of course it is. But you know, it's that same thing. Everybody has a right to do their own thing, kind of.
Well, libertarianism is actually a bastard child of Proudhon as well. And libertarianism is, I would say it again, a castrated version of anarchism. I've always said that libertarians are like a effeminate anarchist, in the sense that they, I would say that because libertarians are basically anarchists, but they don't have really the guts to be revolutionary enough to be anarchists. So they would say, no, I want to do whatever we want. I agree with everything in anarchy, but we should have some police, right? Some once in a while, and some sort of government for something, right? But they're basically emasculated anarchists. Anarchists would also have a police, and they would also have a military. But some people have this view of anarchism that somehow means that everyone's like running naked, crazy in the streets and stabbing people. But the political concept of anarchy is actually that you could have your own police if you wanted to, and your own army if you wanted to, but it would have to be chosen within that community, and it would have to represent that community. Modern anarchists are really what's called anarcho-communists, which a man named Kropotkin, who was actually a Russian aristocrat, basically came up with it in a way. And these are more like communistic versions of anarchy. Ironically enough, Marxist communism, the end result of socialism, is actually anarchy. In other words, he actually advocated anarchy as the end result of the socialist state. It's just that he believed that to get there, you have to somehow centralize power and force people to get accustomed to sharing. So therefore, after the last revolution of eliminating the state, everyone would live in a commune. Anarchist philosophers at the time thought that Marx was nuts, because how can you decentralized power, be a person who advocates decentralization of power, but at the same time advocate giving more power to the state. You know what I mean? It sounds crazy, and I know the answer. The answer is because Marx was a Jew, and he was speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He didn't really want any of this. He just wanted to basically water down socialist movements, and he achieved it via his view of the world, right? But you do have a lot of national anarchists in Europe. You have some here, like the Bay Area anarchists. Those are national anarchists. They're white nationalists here in the United States. They're not very big. They're a couple guys. But my point is, in Europe, it's a lot larger. I mean, you see them with black flags. The next time you see like white nationalists marching in Europe, just look at the blocks of people, and you'll see the ones wearing all black with black flags are basically national anarchists. That's what they are.
And they march with the white nationalists?
All these people
are getting, you know, get along together.
Yeah, most of the what's called the Black Bloc, which is has some anarchists who are anti-nationalists, and has anarchists that are nationalists. The Strasserites, all these guys kind of get along pretty much. The National Socialists too over there, because a lot of National Socialists don't mind marching with anarchists either, because they all have the same basic idea, which is a strong defense of ethnicity, the defense of race, a socialist economy, a decentralized type of socialist economy, and a breakup of the European Union. So they basically agree on almost everything. They just disagree on what kind of particular system you would impose. But again, remember that because the idea is that every ethnicity should have their own thing, then there's no point in disagreeing, because if a Belgian wants to have an anarchist commune of white nationalists, that's his business, whereas a German wants to have a more socialist, like a national Bolshevik movement, that's his, you know what I'm saying? There's,
mm-hmm.
as
yeah,
long
they
as they agree on the
alone.
Yeah, exactly. As long as they agree on the basic race issue and social issue, everything else is, for now at least, everyone's getting along, right? And Russia, you have the National Bolsheviks. I mean, they're pretty aggressive. They have huge movements over there. They get arrested all the time, put in prison. I mean, it's crazy. But those guys, I mean, they march around with pictures of Stalin and Hitler. I mean, irrespective of how you see it, the point is those guys are there. And they're a huge movement in Russia. And again, a lot of them march along with the anarchists. And you think that's crazy because you have a Stalinist with an anarchist. If Stalin were alive, he would have killed them. But apparently they're getting along for now.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Severus, so we hope that you won't drop again, but it comes back. It comes back after a little bit. We can understand you. Is there such a thing as a left and a right anarchism? I mean, there are left anarchists and anarchists have now moved over, they say, to the right. They're disillusioned with the left.
Well, the thing is, traditionally speaking, an anarchist cannot be either left or right, because an anarchist rejects government. If you reject government, you reject a revolutionary way of dealing with government, and you reject a conservative way of dealing with government. But the thing is, the anarchism has a lot of branches. So you have anarcho-capitalists, which most anarchists hate, but there's a lot of them. You have anarcho-capitalists, you have anarcho-communists, you have anarcho-national anarchists. In reality,
well, what about racialism? I mean, there's some anarchist groups now who say that they support racialism, but I would think that mostly in anarchism they would reject racialism.
Well, actually, a real anarchist should not reject racialism. It wouldn't make any sense, because an anarchist believes in freedom of association. So if I'm a racist,
yes,
and I want to hang out with my own people, it would be an oxymoron for an anarchist to say, no, you can't, and I'm going to force it on you, you can't be insane. So a real anarchist would be crazy, and that's why the majority of these people around that call themselves anarchists are not true anarchists. Because
well,
a true anarchist should not reject it.
I got the impression from some of these anti-Antifa and anti-racist groups that are out there making a lot of noise with their face masks on and so on, that they were anarchists among them. That's a lot of them were anarchists. Is that, how did I get that? Is that from the media?
Yes. No, that is true. No, that is true. They do consider themselves anarchists, and they also consider themselves, they have like Marxists and anarchists hanging out together, which is ridiculous. See, that's my point. My point is that the problem with these groups, and I'm saying this I dislike these people, right? But being the most fair I can be, I'm in all honesty saying that they're the most inconsistent and moronic anarchist and Marxist I've ever heard. Because first of all, Marxist and an anarchist should not, it doesn't make any sense to be fighting necessarily alongside, at the same time beating up on people, because the anarchist should be beating on the Marxist and vice versa, right? And second, a true anarchist trying to impose a concept of association is an oxymoron, because the anarchist does not believe in the imposition of modes of association. They believe in the complete and absolute right of people to associate however they want. So it would make sense if their argument is, oh, but fascists want to impose their views on us, that's why we fight them. That's their argument. But the point is, the fascists that they're fighting could only be a threat if they're in power. But if you're just fighting against a white nationalist in a diner who's basically arguing that he wants an ethno state, well, fighting that guy is absolutely insane, because that guy is just advocating a form of association that is different from yours, and that's completely consistent with true anarchism. So I think that most of those kids are just idiotic, and they just don't have any real conception of me or any real conception of politics. And if all they have to do is read Bakunin, read Kropotkin, read Pradhan, I can give them a list of things to read, and after they read them, then we can talk again, and probably they'll be a little bit more mature about their attitude about the issue, right? Because their own guys tell them that perspective is absolutely insane.
Yeah, well, there's so many that don't read.
Yes, of course they don't read.
But you said in the beginning that they have to read, that, you know, anybody who's politically active has to read and have an understanding of what they're talking about.
Has to be educated. And these guys, the problem is that consumerism and capitalism, that's what's ironic about the whole thing. Those kids are the pure reflection of capitalism, because their political views are basically items of consumption. See, they're consuming political ideologies. They're not really living them, or they don't believe them, or they don't really practice them. They consume them like they're consuming Cheerios or consuming any other product. They watch a movie, they listen to like The Exploited, or listen to a punk band, whatever punk band, Sex Pistols, whatever. And they say, oh, these guys are crazy, and they say they're anarchists, so I'm an anarchist too. So they're consuming that subculture, right? That they spike their hair up and they tattoo their face, and some of them are anarchists. But they have no real basis, no foundation, political foundation to be anarchists. The same thing, that's to them, right? I'm going to criticize our own people, and our own people, I mean, we have our own people that are anarchists, but what I mean is our own branch of white nationalism is that applies to national anarchists, which are racial. I mean, any person that calls themselves national anarchists are basically racial anarchists. But that also applies to national socialists. That applies to national Bolsheviks. That applies to right-wingers, whatever. We have to educate ourselves, or at least we have to find people that are willing to do it and to educate and lead the people who may not want to, but want to, but are willing to follow. Because in life, you do have leaders and you have followers, right? So we need people that are willing to educate themselves and become active revolutionaries. And those who are less of that fashion, they should be willing to then follow to all those who are legitimately looking out for their best interests. And that is the basic premise of the leadership principle in the true sense of the word. And I agree with the leadership principle in that sense. And I agree with vanguardism in that sense. And I hope that more people dedicate time, instead of watching stupid movies or listening to stupid things, to actually grab a book, read, listen, investigate, study, and become true revolutionaries. You know, Carolyn, what's funny about this whole thing is, I don't know if you've seen this before, but if you study Soviet Russia and a lot of these revolutionary cells in that time, you can say whatever you want about them. But if you notice, they dedicated a lot of energy to indoctrinate the masses, indoctrinate their fighters with Leninism and Marxism. They would put flags with the faces of Lenin and Marx on them. They would force books on them. They would give them pamphlets. They would force them to read in the front. They had a constant process of re-education. There was obligatory and it was constant. And why am I mentioning this? Because it was actually very effective. It made these people political warriors, and they achieved a lot of victories for that reason. If we apply the same principle and we apply it now, we would do good.
Yeah, we need a lot of organization, and there needs to be somebody to organize around, something to organize around. There's a lack of that. Are you still there? Oh, I think he disappeared again. I wanted him to have some final words on this charge. Let's see if Bill's hopefully he's trying to get him back. And let's see what he says here. It looks like he's still here. Are you still here? Can you hear me, Severus? Well, he's not answering. There's something dark over his symbol. Well, what does that phone there mean? I want to ask him. I don't know if he can hear me. I wanted to ask him about this charge, which is so brought up so often by Strasserites and third position people. Shows that he's here. No, he's not here. I'm here now, but I don't have the answer to this. I do have some answers. Okay, I'll just try to take hold here for the last few minutes. Gregor Strasser, supposedly, they say, was killed during the 1934 Night of the Long Knives. And they hold Hitler responsible for that. They say it was a terrible betrayal. And that's when he, they really did everybody wrong. But it is said that he was killed by mistake. That when this whole episode was going on, he wasn't meant to be killed. But he was, and that Hitler was very upset when he learned about that. I can't say any more about it. than that right now, but I imagine Severus could if we got him back. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this has been a great program. I enjoyed it myself very much. I might just bring it to an end at this point because I don't want to just drag around here waiting for him, and I don't have anything more to say about what we've been talking about. But I think it's all been very informative, and I know that our friend Severus is very well read and studied about all of these things, and he's very fair-minded. And he's a absolutely loyal white man and for the white race. And so this has been just a really nice experience tonight and kind of fun doing this off my website. And I hope that, though, that next week at 9 Eastern on Monday night, the Heretics Hour will be coming from the White Network, and it will all be, everything will be in place, and we'll have a new experience there, and that first program there is going to be Tan Stoffel is going to be my guest is going to be on with me, and we're going to talk about the network and what we want to do with it and how it's okay. Severus is back here again. So Severus, did you by any chance hear my question of you about Gregor Strasser?
I'm here.
Yeah, hi. I wanted you to speak a little bit before we close off. We've got a few minutes. About the anger that Strasserites have toward Hitler for supposedly having Gregor Strasser murdered during the Night of the Long Knives, and I said that I think he was killed by mistake. And do you know anything about that? Can you add anything to that?
Well, to the technical aspect of if he was killed by mistake or not. To be honest with you, no. I don't really have an opinion about that because the problem with that entire period is that it's a very controversial period in National Socialism, and it's also very obscure. Like you said, some people claim that it was a mistake. Some people claim that it was purposeful because he was becoming an annoyance. What's interesting about that is that Strasser, Otto Strasser, didn't really address that much. He basically dedicated more time to this whole revolutionary issue and more into the principle of the thing, right? I mean, remember, he did return back to Germany after the war, and he basically started his own party, right? So in the German Social Union, which was considered a Nazi party at the time, so it was eventually it had to be taken down. But he was more interested in that issue, Hitler betraying the German people, in his opinion, and not really concerned that much with, at least that I haven't read anything. He talks about his brother being murdered, but I haven't heard any of his theories about it, is my point.
Okay, well, that's it. That's all you can say about it. You don't... I was saying before when you were gone, it's brought up a lot by third position people and saying that, not only did Hitler betray all the Germans, he killed his friend Gregor Strasser during the Night of the Long Knives. That was just a terrible thing. And,
I don't think that there would be, I mean, the thing is that because Hitler was in control, you could argue that Hitler theoretically killed him. But I think that at that time with the Night of the Long Knives, a lot of people got killed without necessarily Hitler wanting it, right? I mean, that's just a reality. So you could make a fair argument that Hitler was not a vicious person who would specifically target Gregor Strasser to be killed just because he had a dispute with him. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess people would say that I'm trying to see the best of it, but I mean, it's a legitimate way of seeing it. I mean, at the end of the day, once you have a purge like that, a political conflict like that, some people are going to get killed, and sometimes not necessarily the best of circumstances in which you can control who gets killed and who doesn't, right? So I think that'll be the best way of seeing it. I just think that the legacy of this whole thing is the political movements of Europe today, which I would argue that they are primarily Strasserite in their viewpoint and not necessarily Hitlerite in their viewpoint. So I guess at the end of the day, the Strasser faction kind of won. But I think the truth of the matter, though, is that if you look at most nationalist movements there, they don't really insult Hitler. And I think that if you can make the argument that Hitler and Strasser kind of have become one when it comes to most movements. I mean, a lot of people still see Hitler's Germany as something positive. I haven't met any Strassreiter that said that it was a horrible civilization, right? Like, oh, how horrible was the Third Reich, right? They just claimed that it could have been better, right? So it could have been sustained. It could have survived. It could have averted war, that type of argument. So I think at the end of the day, they both came out fine in the context of our history. I think both men are important in our history, and I think white nationalists shouldn't reject Strasser for the sake of Hitler, or reject Hitler for the sake of Strasser. I think that the white nationalists should, in hindsight, study both and respect both for what they are in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I appreciate your giving that view. That's very different from anything I've thought or wanted to think, but I've never studied Gregor Strasser. And I've learned a lot from you tonight, and I'm sure the listeners have, and those who will listen to it in the future. So this is I really appreciate what you have brought to us tonight, Severus. And I appreciate you, Graham.
I appreciate it.
Well, I know you do. You're just a terrific fellow. So I think we will now. Say goodnight to everyone, and if you have any last words besides saying goodnight?
I would just like to encourage our own people to become have a little bit of that spirit, of that radical spirit that a lot of our ancestors had, not only in this context that we're discussing, but even before. We should have more of this spirit of radicalism and revolution, because in the moment that we're in right now, we're about to die. We're basically getting murdered figuratively and literally, and we need to fight back. And some of that spirit is crucial. So that's what I would like to do. I hope people get inspired by that, no matter how they see it, and fight back.
All right. Thank you very much. Bill, I think we are going to say goodnight now, so you can start the music if you have some to lead us out of the show, or we'll just close off. Good night, everyone.
My child, you say to me, I